It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jov Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning, Jov.
Good morning. You know, it is a measure of how infrequently we have sunny days in the city of Seattle that I've been doing this program for 8 years, and I never noticed before that this is an east-facing window. There's like a sun outside this window. It's bizarre.
By the end of the half hour, that sun should be shining directly in your eyes. So
yeah, it is doing that right now, actually. It's kind of amazing.
I'll adjust that in just a sec.
Okay, yeah. The Kleagle lights are a nice touch, too.
Yeah, and just answer the questions, Jov. Answer the questions.
I'll do my best, officer. But you may not actually get the truthful answer, of course. But our listeners have come to expect that from all this left, you know, liberal media propaganda and all that.
Exactly. We spin it out as fast as the turntables will allow us.
Yes.
So no Maria this week.
She's
recuperating.
Yeah, she actually makes her living, among other things, preparing tax returns. And so she's still recovering, actually. April 15th is sort of an annual holiday each year for her, but which by the end of it she's been working her fingers to the bone for the past month and a half or so. So she's sleeping in a bed somewhere in a secure, undisclosed location in Seattle.
And trying to grow back the skin on her fingers.
Exactly. And we will have her back next week, I hope. But she's taking a well-deserved break this week.
We're keeping our fingers crossed. So
yes.
Well, speaking about being under the hot lights, Tuesday was parts of it. There was a press conference for our current resident of the White House, and there was points of it where he looked kind of like a doe.
He was melting
in the headlights.
He did very, very badly. And one of the things that it was interesting because the media coverage after the press conference really has shown how far. Speaking of the liberal media, because, of course, at this point, right-wing talk radio is talking all about liberal media because of the relentless attacks, quote-unquote, on President Bush. Because if you contrast what Bush has to Bush's coverage was like, you know, 2 years ago, where he could do no wrong. He walked on water and so forth. A lot of the factual depiction of how Bush did in that press conference was really pretty hostile. And it does remind us once again, you know, going either way of how much difference can be made in supposedly objective media by the choice of an adjective here or there. But one of the things that was common to all of this coverage was real skepticism about George Bush's saying he had never made a mistake. The lead in the AP story on Wednesday morning was talking about Bush speaking of his policies with absolute certitude and other sorts of phrases that just make you think, if you're an ordinary reader, gosh, this guy isn't connected with reality, is he? And between that coverage and the actual performance itself, where he was really stumped by the question if he'd ever actually done anything wrong. You combine that with current events, and particularly Iraq, but also the economy, also the war on terror, also the 9/11 commission, and a picture emerges of a president that, forget ideology, because the swing votes that will determine the election this fall aren't going to be persuaded by ideology. They're people, you know, by and large in the middle or off on, you know, one area or another that isn't really defined by ideology. They're going to be swayed by John Kerry, first of all, and by the performance of President Bush, how he's done the last 4 years. And forget ideology. I'm becoming increasingly convinced that John Kerry is going to win the election in November, and I don't mean that as we can all relax and exhale and breathe a sigh of relief. A lot can happen between now and then, and there's a lot of work to be done between now and then, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the events this weekend to work toward that later in this program. But For the voters that will swing this election, both ideologically and in terms of geographically where they're located in some of the key swing states, and Washington State is counted as a swing state by a number of political analysts, what will determine this election is the perception of whether George Bush is competent for another 4 years or not. And the picture that is increasingly emerging from these press conferences, from the inability to take responsibility when errors are made, or even admit that errors are made, or even seem to be vaguely aware that something's going wrong in the world, the picture emerges of a president who is not competent to have the most powerful job in the world, of a guy who has made terrible, terrible militarily strategic errors in his occupation of Iraq. You know, forget for a moment whether the occupation should be happening or not. The fact that it's trying to be done on the cheap with probably a third of the number of troops that are necessary to try and do what they're actually trying to do in Iraq is a terrible strategic mistake and a terrible misuse at the cost of some American soldiers' lives and the lives of many, many more people within Iraq itself, of Iraqis themselves, I mean. You know, it's a terrible strategic mistake that's being done for fairly blatantly political purposes to try and, you know, stem there being more objection to the war at home. You know, the whole body bag factor of the supposed lessons from Vietnam, that people won't object to a war until they see body bags coming home on the evening news. Therefore, we don't allow the body bags to be shown in the evening news, and we try and minimize the number of soldiers that are at risk in the first place. But then you defeat that purpose by increasing their risk exponentially and you know, not setting them up for failure, in other words, not even giving them a chance to succeed at the job, whether or not the job is one that's appropriate to be done. And, of course, that's another whole level of argument, that the job is not appropriate to be done in the first place. And we'll talk a bit about Iraq in a minute. But the press conference and the interview on Meet the Press a few weeks ago, where he also did very, very poorly, any time he has these unscripted moments where he's even being asked remotely challenging or assertive questions by the reporters in attendance, George Bush does not seem to know how to handle adversity. And this should not surprise us. He's probably been surrounded all his life by nobody, with the possible exception of Mama Bush, who would ever tell him no, who would ever say, this is a bad idea, and here's why. Who would ever rein him in? He's a rich boy who's never had to work hard in a day in his life, swept through his daddy's money in a bunch of business ventures, and when that went awry, he swept through a bunch more of daddy's friends' money, and then got rich in the process himself, even though he left all his other investors holding the bag. He is not except that he did make money running a baseball team, which is pretty hard to lose money on. And it's remarkable that this is a guy who is in the most powerful position in the world who does not seem to have any sense of what adversity is like. And adversity is a daily fact of life for most of the 6 billion people on this planet. It's really kind of a frightening thing, the certitude that we keep hearing about in these press reports. And the more and more we hear those reports, the more I become convinced that, you know, George Bush's biggest concern in this fall's election is not John Kerry. It's running against George Bush. He's got to beat himself. And I don't think he's going to, because I think the perception that swing voters have of how competent this guy is steadily declining. And I don't know what between now and November could happen that could reverse that perception.
And like you said at the start, a big contributor to that perception is that fact that the media appears to be focusing more on his failings.
Yeah, and think what a difference we could have in this country right now if the media had been willing to do that in the days and weeks following 9/11. We wouldn't have the Patriot Act. We maybe wouldn't, you know, be mired down in two wars in other parts of the world. We maybe wouldn't have troops in 45 or 50 other countries facing active gunfire, and another 100 countries beyond that where they're just helping out with the local goons. I mean, you know, there you could just go down the list of things where greater accountability by this administration could have made a huge difference. And I'm glad that it's finally happening, but it's taken a long time, and, you know, we've still got a few months between now and November where an awful lot can happen.
Right. They still have plenty of campaign contributions, both parties, to contribute towards advertising and the very media that currently is criticizing them.
Yeah, and money speaks a long ways. And, you know, John Kerry is raking in a fair amount of money, but it's not even close to what President Bush is bringing in. He was a lot of eyebrows were raised last year when the Bush crew said that they wanted to raise $200 million for this election, which is double the previous spending record for an election, which was set by George Bush 4 years ago. They've already raised over $180 million. they're probably going to be closer to $300 or $400 million by the time this is over. It's staggering how much money they're raising, most of it from corporate America and the very wealthy. And most of it is, it's thinly disguised bribes. It's thank you gifts for what's been done over the past 4 years for corporate America and the very wealthy and prospectively what would be done for another 4 years. So that money will buy a lot of advertising. It will buy a lot of spin. It will buy a lot of patriotic gloss on what's really been a pretty reprehensible performance over the last 3.5 years.
All right. Well, moving along, there was also there was multiple press conferences this week, but there was another press conference actually yesterday that Bush was involved in, Bush and Tony Blair.
Yes.
And that had to do with development this week with an Israeli. Do they call it a peace plan? What are they calling it?
Well, a plan for unilateral withdrawal, basically. And this was something that came up on Wednesday. Bush and Blair, by the way, the media in Britain this morning is howling that Blair went along with this, both in terms of the United show of support for Iraq and also Blair's refusal to criticize Bush for the change in U.S. policy. On Wednesday, when Israeli Prime Minister and unindicted war criminal Ariel Sharon showed up for a White House visit, George Bush took the occasion to announce a major, major shift in United States policy toward the Iraq-Palestine conflict. That is, that even though in practice the United States has not done anything about it and obviously has the leverage to do something about it, but rhetorically at least, for the last 37 years, the U.S. has been wringing its hands and saying, Iraq, you should not be occupying these lands that you seized during the 1967 war. You shouldn't be in the Golan Heights. You shouldn't be in the West Bank. You shouldn't be in the Gaza Strip. You should not be putting settlement, basically suburban subdivisions on Palestinian land and expropriating Palestinian houses and whole communities in order to do it. You shouldn't be taking Palestinian water rights, yada, yada, yada. And the U.S. condemnations, while they didn't have any practical effect on the Israeli side, what they did do was, for Palestinians, it gave the United States legitimacy as a potential broker of a peace plan, because the United States really is the only power out there that has the kind of leverage to bring Israel to the table for any kind of peace negotiations. Well, Ariel Sharon, in the past couple of weeks, has come to a unilateral decision. He and his conservative Likud government have come to a unilateral decision that the peace process has stagnated, largely because of their behavior, and that they didn't want it to stagnate, and so that they have announced this unilateral plan whereby they would withdraw their troops from the Gaza Strip, troops that had not been there until a year or two ago. They would withdraw some settlements, in fact, all settlements from the Gaza Strip and a handful from the West Bank. But in exchange for that, they would keep all the rest of the settlements that they have put into the West Bank, and they would essentially it would expand Gaza Strip out to being a giant walled prison, and then they would have a couple of smaller enclaves within the West Bank, and Israel would take over the rest, and it would also make the giant wall that is building, as a dividing line to keep Palestinians out of Israel proper, that would become permanent. The Israeli daily Haaretz, which is sort of the voice of conscience within Israel on a lot of these issues, basically blasted the plan on a front page editorial as being functionally no different than apartheid South Africa's plan to set up Bantustans. And that's exactly what it is. The United States has now endorsed the Bantustans, is what it boils down to. And the practical plan of the effect of this, because again, functionally the United States has not been pressuring Israel, and certainly for the last 3 years, George Bush has given Ariel Sharon everything he's asked for and done very little other than occasionally look the other way when Sharon has perpetrated one or another atrocity or war crime on the Palestinian people. But the functional effect of this is to further alienate Palestinians. And you remember a few weeks ago when Israel assassinated the sheikh who is the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas, how for the first time ever you had Palestinian resistance groups saying that in the future we're going to exact revenge not just against Israel but against the United States as well. We're going to carry out suicide bombings and other terrorist acts within and against the United States and against American targets. This is something that had never happened before because the Palestinian cause, even the most radical elements within it, wanted to preserve the United States as a potential broker of a peace plan. Well, that's off the table now, and because it's off the table, I mean, it's even further off the table now, and we've further enraged the Palestinians now because the United States has basically sided with Israel, saying we're going to set up these Bantustans, we're going to set up a permanent apartheid regime, and you know, unlike every other country in the world, it is a very similar thing to South Africa, where they sent up these Bantustans, but no country in the world recognized that they were legitimate except for South Africa. Israel's going to do it, and one country in the world is going to recognize it as legitimate. That is, George Bush will, if he continues to be the president as the plan is enacted. Now, on May 2nd, Sharon faces the final hurdle to actually putting this plan into place, which is a referendum within his Likud cabinet. There are some conservative members of his own party who object to this plan because they don't want to give up any of these settlements. They're from the minority religious parties on the extreme right. So what is probably going to happen is that the plan will pass. The conservative ministers will resign because those minority parties are necessary for Sharon's party to have a majority. He will probably have to form a new government with some members of the labor opposition. But the plan is likely to go forward at this point. And the one country with leverage to have slowed it down, the United States, is now said it's full on board. And because Tony Blair said that he was willing to countenance George Bush having done this, he's likely to face fierce questioning when he arrives home in Britain today.
All right. Well, as if things weren't warm enough in the Middle East, then this week in Iraq, things continue to heat up there as well.
Yeah, we had the supposed ceasefire in Fallujah, and as we heard on Counterspin, that ceasefire has always been something of a mirage, and the idea that the United States was unilaterally withholding fire has some basis in reality, because the amount of the firepower that the United States could be dropping on Fallujah is far greater than what it has done. But it does have snipers set up throughout the city. The dead and wounded, by virtually all accounts except that in the official U.S. Spokes rooms and their media hand puppets, virtually every other yes, looking at your hand there, virtually every other international media outlet has described most of the dead and wounded in Fallujah as being women, children, civilians. Again, something that is likely to inflame and further harden attitudes against the United States by ordinary Iraqis. At the same time, the most important political development in Iraq, and as we get closer and closer to the June 30 handover deadline, the politics becomes increasingly important, and I'm sure Maria will be talking about this in coming weeks. Also, but the most important development this week was Lakhdar Brahmi, who is the UN envoy to Iraq right now. He had been in Iraq for the last 10 days or so, interviewing the various parties and trying to come up with a brokered plan for a potential governmental structure in the future. And it tells you where they are right now, that they don't even know how the government, what structure the government will have, let alone who can be found to serve in it. And we're, you know, something like 11 weeks away now from the actual handover, 10 weeks actually. His plan, which he presented toward the end of the week, and which has drawn very mixed reactions from the Iraqi National Congress and from various other leading figures in Iraq, but some supportive statements from President George Bush, interestingly enough. The plan calls the structural elements that it calls for have met with less criticism. They They include the idea that there would be a prime minister, there would be a president, there would be two vice presidents, and then there would be a national council of some or another kind, almost like the Liajirgas in Afghanistan, in order to develop some sort of a sort of place-holding national assembly that would have a consultative role until full elections could be held next January. That's the less controversial part, and because it has the backing of Bush, it's likely to be the structure that winds up being enacted, that or some version of it. What is more controversial that Brahmi made the recommendation of and the Iraqi National Congress itself would cease to exist, which is an element of virtually all of the plans that have been floated. The INC has been a disaster. It has almost no legitimacy among the Iraqi people. It's very clear that for any plan to have a chance of having legitimacy, it has to involve different people than have been cooperating with the Americans to date. And the question of who can be found who will be willing to cooperate with an American-imposed government is pretty critical. And one of the reasons Bush has been willing to countenance a UN plan rather than his own is because if it comes from the United States, it has far, far less chance of acceptance among the Iraqi people right now. It's really a tacit recognition of just how little legitimacy the U.S. is seen as having by ordinary Iraqis, and also that they're spinning us a line when they're telling us that the insurgents are a small minority and most Iraqis are happy to see us there. If they felt that most Iraqis were happy to see us there, then they would also feel that an American devised plan would be accepted by most Iraqis, and clearly they don't feel that. But the piece of the UN plan that was particularly controversial was the idea to allow former Baathists into the party or into the ruling coalition and the legislative assembly that would be devised for July 1st. And Brahmi's logic is impeccable. The logic basically is, look, running a country is technically a fairly complicated thing, and the people who have experience at it for the last 35 years, the only people who have experience at it are people who were involved with the former Baathist Party. the former Baath Party, rather. And not all of those people were loyal supporters of Saddam Hussein. Some of them were people who had technical skills, who were in the government because of those technical skills, and whose technical skills would be valuable. The people in the INC and a number of other people within Iraq just don't want any of the people who have former ties to Saddam Hussein's party to be involved in the current government. And of course, as we've mentioned on this program before, because of fairly lax screening by the United States, you already have some Baathists in positions of power that the United States is, and other ruling forces have tabbed for local governing councils and for other places where things are sometimes running fairly smoothly. But that's the most controversial element. But we'll see in the coming weeks how quickly and whether that plan gets traction or not with the Iraqi people themselves, because that's going to be a fairly critical question in determining how much bloodshed is going to be between now and the July 1st handover, and then after the handover particularly.
All right. Well, moving along, speaking of handovers, April 15th, a lot of people handed over earnings to our federal government. And I know a lot of people, I know where a lot of the money goes.
that's because you're paying attention. Yeah, as usual this year, there were folks leafleting in front of some of the various post offices in the city, and in particular talking about where the money does and doesn't go. The figures that are put out by the government in this respect are fairly misleading, because they include the trust funds like Social Security, Medicare, in the percentage of overall spending. When you take out that money, which Congress has no actual control over, the money that Congress actually does have control over, which is the budget that Bush or whoever is in the White House proposes each year, it turns out that about 49% of the money now goes to either current or past military spending. Now, that does not include, for the current year, money that's going to be needed to fight the war in Iraq. Remember that for the budget this year, the White House did not include any of that money. It's going to have to come from a supplemental bill similar to, but probably much larger than, the $87 billion bill that was passed last fall. That probably will not be passed until after the election this year, which tells you a whole lot about how politically dicey that is seen as being. But $536 billion, B as in billion, for current military spending. Another $349 billion, B as in billion, dollars for past military spending. And there are folks who practice tax resistance, who are interested in not having that money going to the IRS. And it's obviously a little too late for 2003, but it's never too early for thinking about 2004. So if you're interested in doing that, a website to go visit and a group to contact is the Nonviolent Action Community of Cascadia. They have counselors who can talk about the logistics of doing that for reasons of conscientious objection to military spending in particular. Their phone number is area code 206-547-0952, and the website is www.seanacc.org.
Yeah, it's probably a concept you wouldn't want to just decide overnight.
No, you know,
on the 14th of April.
The time-worn line that's used for this, and it's something I write about every year this time, just because it's a good idea to keep sight of. It is supposedly a voluntary system, but you know there are certainly risks involved in doing that. The IRS will not throw you in jail forever. They're a collection agency, and not even a very efficient one sometimes, but. There are risks involved, but there's also risk in passively cooperating with a system that's causing so much death and destruction and mayhem, and that is not spending the money on the kinds of human needs that people expect out of a government.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time, but we wanted to mention that MoveOn.org caught a little flack this week, and they're also having a bake sale today.
Yeah, there was an announcement this week from the Republican National Committee filing suit charging MoveOn and America Come Together and some various other liberal organizations of campaign violations in the ways that they're bundling their earnings, and also naming individuals. The naming of the individuals is really the notable thing about this. This is the sort of accusation that's very common by both sides during an election year. And really the purpose of it is not, you know, it almost doesn't matter whether the complaint is sustained or not. In this case, chances are pretty good that it won't be. But the idea is to scare off potential future donors, particularly very large donors that might have concerns about the legality of their donations. Don't worry about it. The donations are legal. As you say, MoveOn is having bake sales this week. There are, this weekend, there's a number of locations. One, for example, at the Wallingford QFC, another one across the street from Green Lake at what's it say here? The corner of Sunnyside Avenue North and Green Lake Way on the north side of the lake. Do you have a
Solstice Cafe? Has got one of our favorite bakeries is
yeah,
doing something with
they're
it too.
They're good folks.
And they're all over town.
Yeah,
we don't have enough time.
Is there a website?
MoveOn.org, MoveOn.org is the place you want to go to find the one that's nearest you, or perhaps going to be on
yeah,
your
and
path.
Yeah, and there's dozens. So
yeah, there are. There's a lot.
Might as well get fat as long as you're going to do something for a good cause. Get some bakery goods.
Exactly, and stock up because it might be a long winter economically here. So unfortunately, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, who is co-editor at Eat the State. And Jav, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a local publication that comes out every other week with local as well as national and international news and opinion and humor and all that good stuff. Largely a volunteer publication, so we always need your writings, your help in distribution, your help in selling ads, everything else we do to keep us afloat. We also take donations, all that good stuff. It's a free publication. That's why we need all those things that involve money. You can find it where places where free publications are found, bookstores, cafes, that kind of thing. Also, the current and all of the past editions are on the web. We've been going for 8 years now, 270 or something issues, at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, questions, if you have feedback to stories or things you hear on the program, if you'd like to volunteer, if you'd like to make donations, give us a call. The voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.